Housing and Homelessness Prevention will come to order, and we have quorum. We have three items on the agenda today, all of which will be laid over. We have a number of testifiers today, and I ask that you keep your comments to under 2 minutes. Senate File 1511, Senator Bolden, you are already the chair. You may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am very grateful to be before you with Senate File 1511, which is an appropriation for FHPAP. These grants are primarily intended to help stabilize families in their existing homes, to shorten the period of time that families stay in emergency shelters, or to assist families with securing transitional or affordable permanent housing. These grants are generally directed through an RFP process towards households that are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, and people who are experiencing imminent risk of homelessness. So these dollars are incredibly important for people really in the most vulnerable spaces at a most difficult time. Priority uses for this funding includes direct assistance for rent, utilities, eviction prevention, as well as household navigation, case management, and outreach services. I will direct members' attention to the MHFA 2025 report on emergency rental assistance needs, which is in your packets, which found that nearly half of renters are cost burdened for housing, and that about 50,000 people experience homelessness annually. The report estimates that an estimated $350 million is the actual need for this program for emergency assistance solely for income-eligible renters in the state. And I will note that those are heavily disproportionately from BIPOC households, households with an individual with a disability, and households with individuals who identify as LGBTQ. So as we are looking at this program to keep people from homelessness, I want to say just a couple words about homelessness in Minnesota. Over 8,000 individuals currently face homelessness on an average night in Minnesota. And, you know, I think about in weather like we have had this week and blizzards and cold weather, what that actually looks like for Minnesotans. Seniors are the fastest growing homeless population in Minnesota, and over 30,000 seniors are currently at risk of homelessness due to increasing costs of rent. The 2023 Wilder report found that children and youth make up over 40% of individuals experiencing homelessness, and that families make up nearly half of all individuals experiencing homelessness. So members, we are have some excellent testifiers today to speak to the need and value of these dollars, and I will next turn it over to them.
Thank you, Senator Bolden. And next, we have Dan Kitzberg, who will testify. And after that, we have Margaret Kaplan.
Chair.
Senator Drahan.
Before we get started, can we get what is the poverty rate, you know, for a family of four? What's 200% of that, just so members have an idea?
Yeah, we'll ask nonpartisan to help us out. We'll go with the testifier while Ms. Painter works on it. And if Margaret Kaplan is in the room, you can come up to the testifier as well. You can begin.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Dan Kitzberg. I'm the Legislative Director with Minnesota Housing. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Senator Bolden, for carrying the bill. Just wanted to speak briefly to the report, the annual estimation of emergency rental assistance needs. So this was one of the recommendations from the work group on expediting rental assistance that did work over the course of the 2023, the interim between 23 and 24, and was passed into law just last session. And so kind of our first go at it, I think Senator Bolden did a nice job of capturing the highlights. Just briefly by way of methodology, you know, this is a fairly difficult population to track as far as need. And so when you factor in things like people who actually go through the program and are receive assistance, or things like evictions, you end up with something of an incomplete picture of the data. So we actually used extrapolated data from both the American Community Survey and the Pulse Survey which is sort of a newer and kind of novel approach to collecting data from households. But even then, you know, we're somewhat limited based on the households actually respond to those surveys, and we're able to collect data. And so, you know, we'll, over the course of years as we're working on this, continue to be able to refine the data and hopefully be able to drill deeper to better understand those needs. And again, I would just note the flexibility of this program, I think, is really one of the key features of it. So in recent years, the need for emergency rental assistance because of households who've fallen behind has become particularly acute. But it can do lots of different things. You know, it can make a car, pay for a car repair, you know, pay utilities that are in arrears, those kinds of things. So it's really a key need that's being met through frontline staff working with these households throughout the state to shepherd them through a pretty complex process between both state assistance programs and county assistance programs. So just wanted to, whenever I can, you know, really extend gratitude toward our partners in the communities who are helping folks through really difficult situations.
Thank you. And next we have Ms. Kaplan.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Kaplan, and I'm president of the Housing Justice Center. The reason I'm testifying today is I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota ERASE campaign. ERASE stands for Ending Rental Arrears and Stop Evictions, which is a statewide effort to eliminate rental indebtedness caused by pandemic, post-pandemic, prevent evictions, and create support for long-term policy change that allows people to experience housing stability and to end homelessness. And we co-convene this group along with ACER and the Minnesota Housing Partnership. This is a really important program in our mind because right now Minnesota is facing increased evictions. There have been about 3,000 evictions that have been filed so far this year in the state of Minnesota. And this is an issue across the state. So if you look at where the most evictions are being filed, you know, the numbers are going to be where there's the greatest population. But the greatest rates of eviction filing, actually, number one is Dakota County, number two is Roseau County, right? So this isn't just a metro issue. It's not just a greater Minnesota issue. It's an everyone issue. And oftentimes, evictions are filed because people simply aren't able to pay their rent at a moment in time because something has happened in their lives, whether it's a car repair, a healthcare issue, something happened with their children. There's just a sort of a blip in their ability to be able to sustain their housing. And the best way to prevent homelessness is to make sure that people don't lose their homes. This is a very scalable program, so any dollar that goes into it can be put to work on the ground somewhere here in the state of Minnesota. FHPAP has a statewide network of administrators who ensure that people have access to somebody in their community, in their locality, who can assist them in navigating the process. And while it's by no means a perfect program, one of the things I would like to point out is the amount of time, effort, and energy people have put over the last several years in improving the program, including the working group on rental assistance, but also work that's happened within the agency, within communities, and with communities to make sure that this is a program that works for everyone. It's also a win-win as well, too. Not only are families able to avoid homelessness who are at risk of losing their homes sometime for just a few hundred dollars in rent arrears, but also it's a program that allows the landlords to be made whole. They get their rent, they get their money back, right? So it's something that benefits multiple pieces of our economy. It is really important for the health and well-being of families and children all across our state. It's important for employers to have a stable workforce. And also, it's something that will touch every part, every corner of the state of Minnesota and the people who need it most. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaplan. Next, we have Ms. Painter go over the question that Senator Draheim had.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Draheim, the 200% poverty level for a four-person household is $64,300 a year.
Maybe give the one-person household.
It's okay. A one-person household at 200% is $31,300.
Okay. Next, we have Renee Rock and Randy Callahan.
Hello, Chair Port, Vice Chair Bolden, Acting Chair Muhammad, and Lead Lucero. My name is Renee Rock. I am in my second year as a Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless Policy Fellow with a focus on the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, also known as FHPAP, and bring with me personal experience in accessing this program as well. This is a program myself and thousands of households across Minnesota turn to once ineligible for emergency assistance funds when seeking to resolve a negative rent balance or assistance with a mortgage payment. A common scenario that continuously plays out in communities across the state for households are attempts to find resolution ahead of court dates through initiating contact with providers and submitting an application and then sitting in wait for a response. In spite of these efforts, I did not speak with a provider until the day of housing court, only to learn there is not enough funding available to assist me and was offered numbers to other providers who may still have funds available if I was interested in trying. Now, as a housing advocate, I have learned to equate a provider's lack of response due mostly to their lack of funding, which is typically spent within weeks, if not even days. The requirements placed upon providers to ensure their dollars span the duration of a biennium directly impacts and limits the number of households a provider can ultimately serve. This is the reality providers are faced with on a daily basis. Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless supports the funding needed to cover the vast needs of households throughout Minnesota. While most households utilize FHPAP for rental assistance and utility payments, this program is also designed to be used for a wide range of support activities that assist households in obtaining and maintaining housing stability, such as housing and employment search, referrals and case management, to necessary items such as vital documents and furniture. Thank you for your time today and allowing me to speak before you.
Thank you. And Ms. Randy Callahan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and distinguished members of this committee. My name is Randy Callahan. I am the Director of Community Supports at Three Rivers Community Action. Three Rivers is a trusted, local, and effective nonprofit dedicated to providing critical supports to individuals and families in our community. We help them achieve stability through a variety of programs, including housing assistance. FHPAP is one of the programs we administer, which prevents families from becoming homeless. Three Rivers administered $5 million in FHPAP funding this biennium, directly supporting hundreds of families. The direct assistance is allocated quarterly, and because the need is so great, the funds are often depleted within the first 2 weeks of the quarter. We see families from all walks of life seeking this assistance. We have served some as young as 20-year-old and some in their late 70s. We serve families with children, youth exiting foster care, individuals fleeing domestic violence, and Korean War veterans, just to name a few. On average, 60% of those we support are families rather than individuals, and 72% of them have income. We assisted a family with two children under five who were at risk of eviction due to car repair, which you've heard often. They were faced with the tough decision, complete essential repairs or to keep their job or pay their rent. Without our assistance, they would have been homeless. The risk of a family not receiving FHPAP funding is dire. Once a family is evicted, finding a new home has become nearly impossible. Not only does eviction disrupt their housing stability, but it also has a lasting impact on the children's education, healthcare access, and overall well-being. We've seen firsthand how displacement can send families into a spiral of stress, and some have nowhere to turn. Looking ahead, if there are federal disruptions or changes to funding, we anticipate even more families will be seeking FHPAP assistance. With the rising costs of housing and living, we expect to see an increase in demand as families struggle to stay in their homes. We know that homelessness is expensive, costing both families and communities far more than just keeping people housed. We know without FHPAP, there will be a flood of families who face risk of living on the street in their cars or in our shelters, and our communities are simply not equipped to meet these needs. I cannot stress enough how critical FHPAP is. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And then next we have Stephanie Lewis.
Good afternoon, Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Stephanie L. Lewis, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Advocacy and Community Impact at Greater Twin Cities United Way. I'm here today in support of Senate File 1511. FHPAP is one of the most crucial systems in the Minnesota housing continuum. It meets Minnesotans where they are and assists them in more ways than any other program in the state. In January, eviction filings across the state surged to 85% above the 2024 monthly average, with 90% of those filings due to non-payment of rent. Greater Twin Cities United Way's 211 Resource Helpline collaborates with four counties to offer intake pre-screening for FHPAP. Unfortunately, the resources requested by households at imminent risk of homelessness far exceeds the resources available. To give you an understanding, in Washington County, they have 12 hours of funding available each month. So if a family cannot access that funding within the first 12 hours of each month, they have to wait again until the following month to be eligible for funding. Again, this means households in need are unable to access the assistance, placing them, again, at imminent risk for homelessness. We know that increased investment in housing stability yield lasting multi-generational impacts, benefiting not just individuals, but whole families. I know this firsthand. After undergoing a major surgery, my mother, when I was a child, suffered a heart attack and was laid off at the same time, putting my four siblings and me at risk of homelessness. A program like FHPAP, back then it was called Emergency Rental Assistance, provided my mom with the rental and utility assistance she needed to regain stability. Today, my siblings and I are building generational wealth through home ownership and entrepreneurship. Greater Twin Cities United Way supports the expansion and increased funding of FHPAP, as stable housing provides a vital foundation that enables thriving children, families, and communities. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Discussion, members, any questions for Senator Bolden or her testifiers? Senator Clark.
Thank you, Chair Muhammad. Thank you, Chair Port. Just want to make a connection between this type of program and how it provides stability in education as well. So I hear too often from my school district, Minneapolis Public Schools, on how when children, well, unfortunately have to move, and then we are busing them to the school from even beyond the borders of Minneapolis, the amount of stress that also puts on our school system. So for me, this is a great investment that will help us be able to spend a bit less on busing our kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clark. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, this Senate File 1511 is laid over for possible, or sorry, do you have any last comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, I want to thank the testifiers who I think painted a very good picture of why this program is so necessary and needed. And thank you, Senator Clark, for making the connection. This isn't just about preventing homelessness. It absolutely is about that, but it is also about healthcare and education. We know that keeping families out of homelessness is not only the thing that is, you know, aligned with our values, it is the fiscally responsible thing to do. It is, in the long run, you know, this investment for folks, which is, you know, sometimes, you know, a bump in the road of a car repair or a medical bill, something that happens in their life that may, you know, be a relatively small amount of money could send them into a spiral with significant and long-term consequences. And so for us to be able to step in and help families get through that time and keep them housed is, again, not only the right thing to do, but is the responsible fiscally thing to do. So thank you, members, for consideration of this bill, and hope we can keep it moving forward.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Bolden. Senate File 1511 is laid over for possible inclusion.
All right, we're going to trade places here, and the next bill will be Senate File 1895, as Senator Muhammad makes her way to the table. When you are settled and ready, you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Before you is Senate File 1895. This important bill continues the bipartisan life safety work the legislature began in 2021. The 2019 Cedar High apartment fire, the 2019 Cedar High apartment fire when several lives were lost. Firefighters were just 5 minutes away and extinguished the fire in just 30 minutes, yet five lives were lost. The fire marshal report concluded that the absence of an automatic sprinkler system was where the fire originated in this building was a major factor in the deaths that resulted. I want to acknowledge today that this is the work of the incredible Senator Carrie Dietzick. After this fire, she immediately took action to prevent it from happening again. The success of this program is entirely due to her effort. After my election, she entrusted me to carry this bill to continue the important work, and we are here today because of that work. Some of Minnesota's most vulnerable people live in older high-rise buildings, many who are most at risk for being injured or killed in fire, including the elderly and those with physical challenges. In 2021, we required fire sprinkler retro in 2019. Sorry, Madam Chair, I'm fasting today, so I can't speak. But in 2019, we required sprinkler retrofits in residential high-rise public housing, providing 12 years for implementation. In 2019, we created an incentive for residential high-rise buildings to be retrofitted with sprinklers and appropriated $10 million to the MHFA to implement for both for-profit and nonprofit buildings, including public housing. There has been an interest in this program, and two projects are almost complete, and I had the privilege of visiting one of them last fall, or this January, actually. What we have learned that while there is interest in both from Greater Minnesota and the Metro, our criteria were too stringent and prevented interested building owners from qualifying. I remain committed to incentivizing residential high-rise building owners to install life-saving sprinklers in their buildings, and thank Senator Draham for his bipartisan work on this. Senate File 1895 expands the criteria and appropriates an additional $10 million for the grant program to reach more buildings with this life safety tool. We now better define a high-rise building since we had interested building owners who learned that their building was as little as 2 feet short of the 75 threshold we used. So expanding to state 7 stories or more, or 75. We modify rent and income limitation applying to the building and allow MHFA program to issue 0% forgivable loans as well as the grants to ensure that all affordable housing as defined by the federal government is eligible for grants if needed. The criteria changes were made in consultation with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. With me today are Tom Bruce, Tim Butler, Craig, and Minneapolis Fire Chief Tyner. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your patience.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Muhammad. We will move to testifiers then. First, we will hear from Dan Kitzberger and then Tom Brace. You both can come up. Mr. Kitzberger, when you are ready, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bolden. Members, again, Dan Kitzberger, Legislative Director with Minnesota Housing. Just wanted to thank Senator Muhammad for carrying this bill. The language portion of it will be included in the agency's technical bill as well that you'll be seeing here within the next, hopefully, week or two. I would just say from the agency's perspective, it's pretty unusual for a competitive program like this to be undersubscribed, and that's what happened. We had a fairly sizable turnout for an informational webinar we held prior to the launch of the RFP. And then once the applications didn't seem to follow the amount of interest, I would just note the community partners did a fantastic job of staying in contact with us to see how implementation was going. And we started to talk about whether these particular provisions around height and around income were perhaps becoming barriers to being able to apply for the program. And so we were able to figure out the language relatively quickly. And so hopefully, once this gets across the finish line, we can get another RFP out relatively soon. So again, thank you, Chair Bolden, and to Senator Mohammed for carrying the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Tom Brace. After that, Tim Butler.
Good afternoon, Madam Acting Chair. My name is Tom Brace. I am the state coordinator of the Minnesota chapter of the National Fire Sprinkler Association. I'm also the longest serving former Minnesota State Fire Marshal. I'm here in strong support of Senate File 1895, chief authored by Senator Mohammed, and recognizing Senators Clark and Graham and their role. This bill would dedicate funding and expand the grant criteria to assist residential high-rise installed and use of fire sprinklers. The revised criteria is critical to the successful retrofitting of our residential high-rise buildings in Minnesota. I personally spoke to disappointed individuals when they learned that they didn't meet the criteria. In one instance, the building was just 2 feet short of the current 75-foot criteria. And that's about 2 feet. I did measure that. We also recommend using the federal government definition on affordable housing, again increasing eligible buildings, as well as ensuring that potential eligible tax credit properties won't run into issues with the IRS rules about grants. Now, if you remember one thing, fire sprinklers buy time, and time buys life. Fire sprinklers rapidly contain fire by activating immediately when they detect heat, not smoke, allowing them to control a fire before it spreads to other floors or areas. Fire sprinklers quickly suppress a fire, providing occupants with valuable time to safely exit the building. Fire sprinklers reduce damage because with early fire suppression, it limits the extent of the fire damage to the building and its contents. Also, fire sprinklers help with accessibility challenges for both firefighters and residents. In high-rise buildings, reaching a fire with traditional firefighting methods can be difficult, making sprinklers even more critical. Due to the potential for rapid fire spread in tall buildings, fire sprinklers are considered a vital life safety measure. Thank you for your consideration of this vital, life-saving legislation. I would turn to my colleague for some important information on residential high-rise building research, Tim Butler.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Tim Butler. After that, Craig Bistadow. Apologies if I'm okay. Very good. Mr. Butler.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Butler. I'm a retired fire chief for the City of St. Paul and a regional manager for the National Fire Sprinkler Association. After the November 2019 fire at 630 Cedar Avenue in Minneapolis, that fire involved 5 fatalities. The Minnesota Legislature, led by Representative Mohammed Noor and the late Senator Kerry Dietzick, began to address the issue of older high-rise buildings that were not equipped with fire sprinklers. The question arose of how many buildings remained unsprinkled across the state. The League of Minnesota Cities, the State Fire Marshal Division, and the National Fire Sprinkler Association began a multi-year project to answer that question. I was one of the principal authors of that statewide survey, and I'm proud to report to you that Minnesota is now one of the few states in the nation with a complete inventory of high-rise buildings. The survey found 624 high-rise buildings in the state. 569 of those are fully sprinkled. Included in those numbers are the Seward Tower West building in Minneapolis and the Seward Tower East building, where sprinkler installation is nearly complete. Both were recipients of the current high-rise sprinkler system grant program. There are 10 unsprinkled residential high-rises in the state. Two of those are public housing high-rises located in Hopkins and North Mankato. Six of them will meet the new lowered height requirements in Senate File 1895, one in Albert Lea, four in Hopkins, and one in North Mankato. In addition, 25 of the state's residential high-rise buildings are only partially sprinkled. Three are public housing buildings located in Albert Lea, Hutchinson, and Pipestone, and five of them will meet the lowered height requirements of Senate File 1895, one each in Richfield, Duluth, St. Paul, Stillwater, and Hutchinson. Madam Chair and members of the committee, your support of Senate File 1895 will have a significant and lasting impact on the lives of Minnesotans. The Seward Tower buildings have a combined total of 640 residential units. That's 640 families protected with just a portion of the high-rise sprinkler system grant program. That's real protection and safety for thousands of families and emergency responders over the projected lifetime of those buildings. I thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 1895, and I'd be happy to address any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Craig Bistedo. After that, Brian Tyner. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Craig Bistedo, and I am a business representative of Sprinkler Fitters Local 417. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 1895. In buildings without fire protection, both occupants and first responders face a severe disadvantage when a fire occurs. Fire sprinklers not only save lives, but they also protect property. I am a Minnesota certified journeyman sprinkler fitter with over 35 years of experience in the trade. And over the past 4 years, I have seen numerous unsprinkled residential high rises and low rises in Minneapolis become fully protected with fire sprinkler systems. However, the job is not done. Senate File 1895 presents an opportunity to prevent future loss of life by ensuring that every residential high-rise in Minnesota is equipped with fire sprinklers. Many such buildings across the state still lack this life-saving technology. By amending the language to the current bill allows for a broader accessibility and securing an additional $10 million in funding, we can extend fire protection to even more residents living in unprotected high-rise buildings. Sprinkler Fitters Local 417 represents over 400 skilled professionals who install, maintain, and inspect these critical systems. Not only do we work in the fire protection industry, but we also are very strong advocates for fire safety. We firmly believe in the life-saving power of automatic fire sprinkler systems and strongly support Senate File 1895. Lawn sprinklers save your grass, fire sprinklers save your assets. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from Brian Tyner. After that, Patrick Hanlon.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I am Brian Tyner, Fire Chief of the Minneapolis Fire Department. I am here to testify in support of Senate File 1895. I had the honor of testifying in support of this program when it was originally debated and passed. And since then, we've made incredible progress, but there is still progress to be made. Decades of data and my 30 years of experience in the fire service have proven that automatic sprinkler systems save lives. No person, to my knowledge, has suffered a fire fatality in a fully sprinklered building that wasn't intimate with the ignition source. In other words, right there on top of it and in the room. Since we passed this bill, the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and Seward Towers and others have been able to retrofit all of their residential high-rise buildings, But again, there is still a need to provide this opportunity to retrofits to other residential high rises and those slightly less than 75 feet. People that live in a seven-story high-rise building that's only 73 feet have the same risks as those that live in a building that's 75 feet, and so that assistance is greatly needed. So with that, I humbly ask that you support Senate File 1895. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Patrick Hanlon. After that, Mike Winshow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Housing and Homelessness Prevention Committee, for allowing me to testify here today. My name is Patrick Hanlon. I'm the mayor of the city of Hopkins. I'd like to thank Senators Muhammad, Clark, and Dreheim for carrying this important legislation, which expands this necessary grant program to help keep residents of public housing properties safe. So thank you so much. We've been searching for resources to address this very precarious safety issue in our community for the last few years. I want to say that we are deeply concerned about finding funding to provide fire suppression for Dow Towers in Hopkins that was mentioned earlier. The situation we have is a potential nightmare in the waiting, similar to the 2019 Minneapolis fire, and I'll tell you why. Dow Towers is a 76-unit, seven-story building which serves residents at the lowest income levels, 30% AMI or less. Many of our residents who live in this building are elderly, with over 78% of our residents having disabilities. We have 10 residents who currently use an electric wheelchair and several who are completely bedridden. In a fire, crews would need to locate and physically evacuate all of these residents. This, of course, endangers our vulnerable residents and firefighters alike. While Fire Chief Winshow spoke yesterday, more specifically on the challenges of fighting a fire at this building, I'll give a situational background in Hopkins. For those of you that don't know, Hopkins is a city of only 4 square miles, with high rates of affordable and naturally occurring affordable housing, and this gives us a very limited tax base from which to operate from. In 2024, our community applied for a high-rise sprinkler grant program that was denied because of the 2 feet, it was 2 feet too short, which is infamous in this hearing now. Coincidentally, our fire trucks are too short to actually fight the fire, meaning we rely on city partners that could cost life-saving minutes in the event of a fire. Small housing and redevelopment authorities like ours face incredible challenges saving for large improvements like sprinkler systems due to HRA constraints. We have taken years to save up just $300,000, and this is nearly $1 million necessary investment in this building. To summarize, we can't save for this project with current fiscal tools. We don't qualify for the existing grant program to leverage what we can save, and we don't have the capacity to adequately fight the fire in the time frame that would save lives. That is why the programs like the high-rise sprinkler grant program are so important. It allows the HRA to use the money it has saved and leverage it with money from the state to make our buildings safer. The recommended changes will make that possible. This housing development and those like it are regional and state assets. In a time where we need deeply affordable housing, it is so needed. Please help us ensure that we can provide a safe place to call home for our most at-risk residents. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, and the authors for this really important legislation and this committee for your time today. I'm available for questions afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And our last testifier, Mike Winshow, please correctly pronounce your name for us and proceed.
Will do. You're not the first one. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Housing and Homelessness Prevention Committee for allowing me to testify today. I'm Mike Winshow, Deputy Fire Chief of the City of Hopkins. Many thanks to Representatives Muhammad, Clark, Dreheim for pursuing changes to this important legislation. The Hopkins Fire Department has worked alongside our HRA team over the past year on seeking funding for Dow Towers, and we're deeply disappointed when our building fell just short of the statutory requirements, making it ineligible for this grant. Current statute for this program requires the building that must be 75 feet to be considered a high rise, which leaves out many buildings like Dow Towers that are incredibly difficult to serve in the event of a fire. The Hopkins Fire Department has a ladder truck which is 107 feet long and reaches up to about four or five stories. The truck is the longest ladder in the Southwest Metro, and if there's a fire on the sixth or seventh story, we'll be unable to reach reach it without any of our fire, with any of our fire vehicles. And the only option is to have firefighters enter the building with the apartment bundles to hook up to the fire department riser in the stairway. This creates a delayed response where firefighters are using stairways to both evacuate disabled residents and fight the fire while other residents may also be evacuating the buildings. Evacuation in a building like Dow Towers, where many of the residents are physically and or mentally disabled, creates a unique challenge where residents may struggle to understand fire alarms or be completely unable to evacuate due to physical limitations. This requires firefighters to both physically evacuate residents while suppressing an active fire. Affordable housing like Dow Towers is deeply necessary in our region, and our residents cannot afford to be displaced by the effects of fire damage, nor could we imagine the devastation if we were to completely lose these deeply affordable units to fire. We know that sprinklers are the best first line of defense in fire emergencies, controlling extinguishing fires before firefighters arrive. They significantly reduce fire damage, saving lives and property. Fire sprinkler systems reduce fire-related deaths by 87% in homes with sprinklers compared to those without. The current code uses square footage rather than height as the determining factor for whether a building must be equipped with a sprinkler system. However, a building's height alone does not always indicate whether residents will be safer or if the fire department will have an advantage in fighting the fire. Changes to this legislation, which would allow our HRA to receive funding, is integral to keeping our residents and our firefighters safe. Again, thank you, members of the committee, for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Muhammad, any comments before we go to questions or comments?
No, I just want to thank our testifiers for taking the time to come out here. And I think this is a really important piece of legislation that we did in 2023. And I think folks are coming back now because they understand how important it is and that we do need to make amend some things to make sure that every building across our state can qualify for the funds.
Okay. Questions or comments, members? Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Muhammad. I think in your opening remarks, you had mentioned you were fasting. My in-laws are all fasting as well, with Ramadan, obviously in the midst of it, leading up to the festival at the end of the month. So I know what you're going through. But anyway, I wanted to just, no question, just a remark. I was in the Public Safety Committee and the other body when this tragedy happened, and I recall the families of some of the victims having come through and shared their testimonies and their horrific impacts to their life. So I have been following this legislation for several cycles now, and I appreciate the effort, and I also appreciate the and thank the testifiers, and I'm glad that we were able to move something in previous sessions, and I appreciate that you're continuing, because yeah, life matters, and we definitely want to do what we can. So thank you again, Madam Chair, and Senator Muhammad.
Senator Muhammad.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Lucero. I think it's important to point out that Senator Putnam actually fasts with me, and so we should have had him present a bill to see how it goes today. But thank you. I appreciate you. And yeah, it's really important, and I appreciate you for noting that.
Other questions or comments, members? All right, seeing none. Any final comments, Senator Muhammad?
You know, I think many bills come through this committee, and there are many things that we fight about across the aisle, but this is one of those bills that brings people together because they understand how important life is, and it's, you know, it doesn't cost much, but we have over 600 buildings that are high-rises across the state, and a number of them don't have sprinkler systems. My district, the sewered high-rise buildings west and east, are able to take advantage of it, and it's really nice to be able to see over 600 residents be safe in their communities, and thank you so much for considering it.
Thank you for bringing this bill. Seeing no further discussion, Senate File 1895 is laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus. We will next move to Senate File 1652, Senator Abler. You may begin when you are ready.
I thought they were all standing for my bill. See you guys.
Well, how to clear a room. Thanks, Madam Chair. There you go. Howdy.
Margaret Kaplan looked at your bill and said there's a provision in there, I believe the second one, that does not include all seniors in the LIHTC buildings.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't.
And, yeah, all seniors need help.
Talk about the problem.
Okay,
this bill is not going to pass.
I know, but then why are we here?
Make sure people understand the problems so they can fix something.
Okay, folks, as we continue to play musical chairs, our next step is Senator Abler's Senate File 1652, Senior Rent Control Bill. Senator Abler, to your bill, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time. And so I'm trying to decide even how to present this. I'm presenting a problem that is a grave problem for many areas of our great city, of our great state, and it is going unresolved, and tremendous harm is happening to people in the face of setting up programs that are ostensibly affordable housing. This program, which is called, I believe it's called LIHTC, the investors, and they're investors, Mr. Chair, I'm very critical of them, the way they've treated my constituents and many across here. The investors get a third of the money from the feds as a tax credit. They go borrow two-thirds of the money, and then they seek a return on all of it. And the people that are housed are limited in their income by definition, and many are not even at the top of the list. I think it's like $40,000 or something like that. And many live on $24,000 a year, Social Security, et cetera. And they've moved into these places with high hopes to be enjoying their golden years in a really nice building. The buildings are very nice buildings. Nobody complains about the quality of the construction or that the hallways are not cleaned or anything. But they're allowed to charge rent increases based on AMI, which is an area median income, I think that's the term. And some are very hospitable in their demeanor. Some of these companies are really pretty thoughtful and they understand their clientele, and others, frankly, are not. And they're allowed. I've talked to Minnesota HFA about it and the Attorney General and tried to make a dent in this whole thing. And so we've discovered in this committee you cannot legislate a conscience. And, you know, when there's money to be had. And so most of late in the COVID time, when AMI was up to 11.8%, I think it was, they thoughtfully raised it 11.8%, while Social Security went up about 2%. And so the proposal in front of us, Mr. Chair, I'll admit, is probably not the final answer to this. And to the carpenters who are concerned, we're not trying to mess up buildings. But it is one way to call attention to the plight of these individuals who are simply trying to live. And we've had some community meetings in, Roseville we went to? We could pack this room out and two rooms full of people who are concerned about this, the very residents who we have spent buckets of money on at the federal level, and therefore from us, to provide opportunities for housing. And the most dramatic case I remember was a woman who's started at $900 and got rid of her house, it cost $1,000. She makes $2,000 a month, her rent is now $1,700, and she says, what am I supposed to do? In the face of oversight by the agency, I'm not faulting the agency, I'm not faulting, you know, anybody. Say, well, why don't you just get some more rent assistance? Okay, well, I'll bring a bill for $100 million in rent assistance so we can rescue these folks. I'm not sure we have the money, Mr. Chair. So anyway, so I've got some amazing people from Coon Rapids that are gonna tell you their story and some testifiers, and then we'll discuss the bill. So I hope that's satisfactory, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Ms. Bregelman?
Okay.
Yeah.
Ms. Bregelman?
Hi.
Could you state your full name for the record and then tell us your story, please?
Okay.
on these.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for hearing us. And I'm Janet Bregelman, and I represent a number of seniors at River North, and then started the Minnesota Tenant Organization, where other Dominion or this non-for-profit developers' buildings, because we've had a lot of grievances with them. And so we've united, and we're probably on our fourth or fifth year trying to get some help from legislation. Now, I know there's lots of opposition against Social Security, COLA minus one, but we're living in low-income housing. These developers actively seek these contracts. They're for-profit, and that should be a red flag right there. And there's lots of documentation, even like Frontline did a special about the abuse that goes on under Section 42 by developers called poverty, politics, and profit. And there's Dateline's done a lot, 60 Minutes did a lot, and 60 Minutes had a special on an executive from the third largest apartment developer bragging how they're doing this low-income housing and then upcharging these low-income people as much as $800 more a month. So I've rented lots of apartments my whole life, and I move into River North because it says affordable housing for seniors. And I asked on the, you know, when you're interviewing to be admitted, how much will the rent go up? Most we've seen is $14 a month. So I went and moved in there, and the very first year it was $50 a month. And then the next year it was more. And the reason we've asked for other legislation to help protect us. The reason it boiled down to Social Security COLA minus one was in 2022, the Social Security COLA was 8.7, and our rent increase was 12.5. In 2023, the Social Security COLA was 3.2, and our rent increase in our building, thanks to our representatives, they got them to sign a letter for a 3% only rent increase, but the other buildings went up 5. In 2024, the COLA went up 2.5, and rent went up 3.5 to 5. We're low income, and I am paying 73% of my income. My rent is $1,600 and $1,607, and I get $2,100 in Social Security, $2,189. I have to pay utilities, your insurance, you know, food. And we, many seniors, are forfeiting, and you know this, meds or eat crappy food because it's cheaper rather than good food. And now, you hear developers saying, well, you gotta protect us. Cost is going up. Well, hello. Seniors don't get discounts at the grocery store. We don't get these discounts hardly anymore. And we need help, real help. And if it can't be this, then please come up with something else. Why am I paying 73% of my income in low-income housing? What do you think is fair? And you look at this for-profit developer and the amount of money they're making. They actively seek these contracts. They have over 50 buildings in Minnesota and probably 30 in the cities. They're making massive profit. And I provided the first 2 years a packet of evidence about the upcharging that they do. Upcharging is $400 for paperwork if you move from one apartment to another. $200 if you drop a cigarette butt on the ground and they catch you. One lady, they DNA test the dogs, and they have a monthly fee for pets, and they still, if you leave a bit of dog do, they charge you $300. And one of the ladies said, I'm poor. I can't pay $300. And she never had done it before. It's just something she missed when she took the dog out. So they go, she said, I'll pay $150 this month, and I'll pay $150 next month. The next month, she went to pay the $150, $87 late fee. And I provided proof of this in writing. So we're not picking on all developers. I've lived in mom and pop apartments. I've lived in other apartments. I have never faced the abuse that we get as seniors in this building. And that's why we're asking for help, some kind of help. If you can't do the Social Security COLA, and you really need to get rid of the AMI, the area median income is here in the cities based on 11 to 13 counties. They average the income of all the people in 11 to 13 counties, and then base our rent, who are on a fixed income, and, you know, on that figure. And so even last year, 4D got fixed to provide developers reduced property tax, and they still left the AMI in there. So this for-profit can get federal tax credit, and they got money from Coon Rapids. They got a low bank interest loan, because trust me, I tracked the money. They also now get reduced property tax if they apply for it, and get to charge us max rent. This is what's wrong. This is why we're begging you, pleading you. And this time, I had a hard time getting this group of seniors to come, because we no longer believe we're going to get help. We're on our fourth or fifth year asking to fix this problem. Not about all developers, because there's nonprofits who aren't doing this. There's mom-pops who aren't doing this. This is a for-profit. And 60 Minutes Frontline have documented the for-profits are abusing this 1986 law, big time. And it's allowed to go on and on and on. So when will somebody care and help us? That's what I'm asking you. All right, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Dawn Cordes. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Dawn Cordes, and I live at River North Apartments in Coon Rapids. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my story. I took care of my mom for the last 10 years of her life. She died at 99. So I kind of went through the whole senior thing with her, thinking, I know what to expect. I know what's going to happen. And when it came time for me to select my what I considered my forever home, I chose River North because it looked good. People were nice. And of course, I moved in March of 2020 when COVID hit. So all of the programs and people that I could see, we were closed off. We couldn't. But one by one, I did meet people in the hall. They were friendly. And within a year, I met a really warm community of people. Fast ahead, so we get through the COVID and we're now interacting, and we have a really good, strong community of people who really care about each other. When we got the 12.8 increase in our rent, I want you to think about this individually. 12.8% on my mortgage every month for the rest of my life, that's what we're paying. So once it got up there, it's not going anywhere. It increases more and more. So I think you can figure out how harsh that is. We probably lost about a third of the people in our community because they had to move. I personally moved because I went to a cheaper apartment. And so even at that, the apartment that I rented originally, within the 2.5 years was up to $159. So it just was unaffordable to me anymore. And it was really a hard blow to understand that this was senior housing. I specifically sought out a community that would be of seniors in my income level that I could grow old with, or older with, I guess. So I first of all want to thank Senator Abler, excuse me, and our legislators that have gone across the aisle to keep fighting for us. But we do need help, seniors. If this isn't the bill, you just have to keep in mind, you're going to be on Social Security sooner or later, if you're lucky, and you'll be looking at the same fight, because it won't go away unless we kind of curb it. So again, I want to thank Senator Abler and you. Thanks for hearing us.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being here. Next, we will hear from Michael Dahl. After that, Cecil Smith.
Okay.
Yeah, fill in your names there. Hey, Michael.
Hi there.
We need to.
Yeah, I don't have it after.
Plug in something.
Yep. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Dahl, and I am the Public Policy Director at Homeline, a statewide tenant advocacy organization. Senator Abler, thank you for your desire to help seniors remain stably housed. For many tenants living in low-income tax credit properties, including seniors, long-term affordability becomes an issue, as has been noted, when landlords raise rents at a pace that exceeds the growth of renters' households' income. Homeline supports finding ways to stabilize rents in these tax-subsidized properties so renters can maintain their affordability of their homes for the long run. Senate File 1652 addresses a slice of the problem. It proposes using a different formula than usual to calculate how much rents can increase in senior-specific low-income housing tax credit properties. Homeline's position is that this committee should question why any household living in any low-income housing tax credit subsidized property, seniors, families, or any low-income household should find their rents increasing consistently outpaced by the affordability over income affordability over the years. Homeline clients, including those that we organize with, express frustration with the disconnect between what's considered affordable. The current formula used to determine rent increases is calculated using a percentage of the area median income at a regional level, which is not in any way an individual household's affordability calculation, which is 30% of the area median income. For decades, the area median income in both the Twin Cities and statewide have outpaced low-income tenant rents, rent gains. Renters may have qualified to live in their homes for the first year of tenancy. However, increases in their rents based on changes to the area median income have resulted in them living in increasingly unaffordable apartments as time goes on. They are paying over 50% of their income for rent, and they are conveying confusion over why they are too poor to stay in affordable housing, feeling that it shatters the perception of affordability of units that the units initially provided to them. I was going to show a picture of, there's lots of different LIHTC properties. Some are seniors, some are advertised as seniors, but they also take families. Some take, there's a large immigrant population that live in low-income tax credit properties. We organize with these tenants. And there are mixtures of people that are finding community in these homes, and they're no longer able to maintain that community as people have to move, has been stated, because their rent increases the pace of the growth in their incomes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And last testifier will be Cecil Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm president and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, known as MHA. MHA is an industry nonprofit representing 2,300 members in over 320,000 units of housing in the state, housing nearly 600,000 of our fellow residents. I'm here today to respectfully raise MHA's opposition to Senate File 1652. Housing economists are only occasionally united in their opinion, but when it comes to rent control, they are. The vast majority of economists, including Paul Krugman, raise red flags about rent control for one simple reason: it doesn't work. The unintended consequences outweigh the benefits. Today, the country looks to St. Paul as an example of the negative consequences of rent control. While this proposal is narrowly focused to a specific program, it will eventually mean broader avoidance and disinvestment. Enacting this bill will ensure Minnesota will not have the supply of senior affordable housing to meet the needs of Minnesota's baby boomers looking to downsize into senior rental housing. This proposed regulatory regime will send development capital to other opportunities where their project will be viable. Under this proposal, the operating math for senior LIHTC does not work. The projects won't be viable. 2 years ago, the legislature provided funds for nonprofit housing providers experiencing financial distress. This proposal would only exacerbate the financial challenges those same operators face. If the goal is to create and preserve housing affordability for low-income and middle-income seniors, the state should look at other options, such as supplemental rental assistance. Given the demographics of our state, Minnesota needs substantially more senior affordable housing in the coming years. This bill undermines that goal. Thank you for your time.
All right, that is the end of our testimony. Senator Abler, any comments before we move to questions from members?
Well, thank you, and I'm new to the committee. Mr. Smith is not. So I understand you don't like our proposal. I don't like it either. I like it, but I don't see it as a practical answer. We brought it up last year, and actually these folks thought of it. This is what they can afford. Just so you know, this is the ability of the tenants to pay. And so Mr. Smith, you can decline to answer or answer, but I appreciate your comments about the bill. And you had not heard the testimony. So can I ask you if, and you can decline, I'm putting you on the spot, but how do you react to this commentary here? And hearing that the very product that we're brought forward here is actually pricing people out of the ability to live there when they went in with high hopes. Do you want to, I'll leave it at that, if you would care to answer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lucero.
I appreciate what Senator Abel is doing, but I think it's not appropriate for legislators to begin challenging other testifiers on bills, and I would hope that our conversation can focus on us as legislators.
Senator Abler. Response. I'll say that.
He's free to decline if he wants, and you're free to go. Thanks.
Look,
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, I'll just say, as a resident of Minnesota and someone who respects our seniors, this is heartbreaking. This is very disappointing that we are in this position as a community with our seniors. And the solutions to this are above my pay grade. I've got suggestions, I've got recommendations, but our state has to make choices and prioritize. And when we hear this concern today, and we think the solution is supplemental rental assistance for seniors who want to live in a safe and dignified place and we need to maintain safe and dignified housing for our seniors, then we have to make the math work. So that'll be that's my only comments, but thank you.
Thank you. All right, members, will move to questions. Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just start by saying I appreciate Ms.
Bregelman
and Cordes. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony. And as I'm listening to you, my heart breaks. I am going to be where you sit now. I'll be there in a few years. My wife and I don't have any children. We've been trying to have children for almost 30 years. The Lord never opened up that door. So when we get to the point where you are, we're not going to have anybody to take. We won't have family to or children to take care of us or help us or move in with or live with. And that day is going to be a challenge for my wife and I when that day comes. And I, again, my heart goes out to you in what's happening here. Madam Chair, Senator Abler, and everybody that's listening, in the multiple committees that we've been in, there are so many systems that are broken right now. We are in the Education Committee. We're listening to how broken education is, how our children are being hurt. I'm not on the Human Services Committee, but we're hearing, we know in multiple other areas how the healthcare system is broken, how the insurance system is broken. We're hearing, I was just earlier this week at a childcare town hall up in my community, and the childcare system is broken. And in this committee, Madam Chair, we're obviously focused on how the housing is broken, rent is broken. There are so many systems are breaking down here. It's not working. And I'm going to be an equal opportunity offender here. I'm just so sick and tired of Republicans and Democrats, politicians at the national level and the state level, right, offering Band-Aids, offering lip service, continuing to spend money, wanting to throw money, wanting to print money out of thin air, throw it at a problem. It's not a solution. And we're seeing now, several decades of this has gone on, Democrats and Republicans, George Bush, Barack Obama, you know, again, I'm not placing blame on any one party or any one president or on the state level here, any particular governor. But several decades of this are coming home to roost. And we have to listen to the testimony, and it all just breaks your hearts. I am so frustrated. I'm so incredibly frustrated. And I have a series of questions here that I'll throw them out there, but I'm not interested in having an adversarial back and forth. But some of the questions in my mind as I was listening to this, you know, having familiarized myself with the bill and listening to the testimony, are how many properties will this bill impact? And I think, I don't want to, it'll just take too long to go back and forth. But I think that this is not narrow to any one particular property manager or any one company. I think it's going to be all properties that are 55 plus that are receiving these credits. So it's going to impact everybody in this. Then the next question on my mind is it going to be retroactive? Would this only apply to new properties that are built or enter into the two criteria, the tax credits and the 55 plus going forward? Or is it going to apply retroactively then to all properties? The next question I'm thinking of is, and I did the analysis here, I just looked at the last 5 years of the inflation. So depending on what website you go to, there will be slight variations of the numbers. But in 2020, the inflation was 1%. The COLA for Social Security was 1.3%. So if you subtract under this bill, it'd be 1.3 minus 1. So it'd be the maximum increase would be 0.3% when the inflation overall was 1%. Going to the next year, inflation was 5.4%. Under the formula, the max increase would be 4.9%. The next year, inflation was 9.1. The max under this bill permitted would be 7.7%. The next year, I have 3.7% inflation, and the max under this bill would have been 2.2, if this bill would have been law at the time, 2.2% increase. And then in 24, the inflation was 2.9%, and under this bill, if it had been law, the max increase permitted would be 1.5%. And I know that's a lot of numbers, and people tune out after the first set, but what it comes down to is the reality is the max increase would have been less than inflation in each of these last 5 years.
Which is the same as I quoted
Exactly. So it's corroborating the numbers. So one of the concerns I have then is, and we already heard it cited by one of the testifiers, St. Paul. What happened in St. Paul? We know that the law of supply and demand is in effect right here. And if
there is less supply but more demand, the price is going to go up. And right now we're in the middle of, starting last year, 11,000 people are turning 65 every single day. Starting last year. And that's every single day for the next several years. We have 11,000 more people that are hitting that retirement age. So the demand is only going to go up. It's continuing to go up. And so if this were to become law, and if we look at the case study of St. Paul when they enacted the rent control, these projects need financing. And because demand is increasing, the only way to meet that increased demand is to meet it with increased supply. The only way to meet increased supply is to build more. The only way to build more is to get financing for these. And what happened when rent control was enacted is the builders who had the desire to build were not able to get the financing because the bankers would not permit or would not approve loans in communities that had enacted rent control. And so that nearly stopped new building in St. Paul. That's my concern that would happen here. Is with 11,000 every single day, we need more supply. The bankers are gonna see this. They're not gonna approve loans. And we just heard the budget forecast earlier today. We're $6 billion in the hole for the next biennium. We can't just say, well, if the lenders aren't gonna approve loans, we'll just have government money put at it. There is no money. There's no money. And so if we stop building the 55 plus communities, it's going to exacerbate the problem. And again, I just come back to, I'm so frustrated. These systems are breaking, and these good people who've worked hard, I presume, harder than I have. You've come through decades of hardship, and now you're trying to live the golden years of your life, and you're having to be faced with this. It's frustrating that you're even down here having to talk about this. You should be out maybe running the playing pickleball, or I was going to say maybe running the Ironman, if that's.
Some of us do.
Yeah. But thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Abler, for the conversation. I vehemently disagree that this is a solution, but we hear you, and I know that it looks dark at the end of the tunnel, but we as Republicans and Democrats need to stop the lip service, need to stop the band-aids, need to stop the sound bites, and need to have actual solutions when all these systems are breaking down. Again, thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Abler, response?
No, I'll let other members.
Senator Draham.
Thank you, Chair Bolden, and thank you, Senator Abler. I think one of the testifiers wanted someone that cared, and I can't find a more caring person than yourself to bring this forward. Thank you. You know, we've served together for 9 years, and had a lot of respect for you. And, you know, the people on the committee have heard me talk about senior housing and how we were going to face real issues in the future. I'm glad we're having the discussion. And I think everybody realizes there's an issue. But I think Senator Lucero kind of touched on it a little bit. It's a supply and demand issue. From 2000 to 2030, our population age 65 and older will double. So in the next 5 years, it would have doubled in the last 30. We don't have enough housing units. And I think Senator Lucero hit it on the head. This will not help us create more rental units. The affordability piece, I am not familiar with how the rents are set. And I don't know if Mr. Kitzberger would want to come up and explain that piece. I think, Senator Abler, you mentioned it was based off of AMI, and then that resets every year. Is that correct? Senator Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, actually,
Senator Abler.
My constituents have become quite expert as well. Mr. Kitzberger can come, but they can answer that question too if you want, unless you want to hear from Dan.
Dan, do you mind coming
Mr.
up?
Mr. Kitzberger?
Yeah. Gotta justify your presence.
Madam Chair, members, Dan Kitzberger again with Minnesota Housing. I was actually trying to find a piece of different information while that was being can you just rephrase the question one more time for me?
Senator Draham.
Thank you, Chair Bolden, and thank you for coming up. I was just wondering, I think Senator Abler mentioned, that it changed with off of AMI. And, I'm familiar with AMI, but I don't know how it resets, if it's an annual thing, and then does the agency set the rules for LIHTC, or is that more of a federal set? Because LIHTC is a federal program, or was originally, I think, Ronald Reagan. So just a little background for the committee would be wonderful.
Mr. Yeah. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, members, regarding the AMI calculation, that calculation is done by HUD, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, done on an annual basis. They calculate AMI regionally by metro area, and then HUD also sets the maximum allowable rent increases based on a variety of factors, as I think seems to be the understanding here. And so we then, issue that documentation to properties in which we're overseeing the compliance that have received tax credit allocations from us. I would note the additional layer to this is the sub-allocators throughout the state that also manage compliance for their allocation of low-income housing tax credits. Mm-hmm. And so I think as far as, the other thing I mentioned is that as far as we oversee what's called a qualified allocation plan that we renew every 2 years. And so as part of that process, that's kind of our implementation, the Minnesota type of implementation of the federal LIHTC rules. And so we have some ability to layer things on top of that, which we've done in the past. However, there is kind of the overlay of the federal rules around LIHTC.
Sure.
Senator Draham.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kitzberger.
I would just note if, yep. if
Mr. Kitzberger.
The residents had anything to add as far as what they understood.
Ms. Brinkelman.
I'm sorry. One of the things to me that I understand for offsetting the inflation in the LIHTC program is the money they get for tax credit. They're being paid by the federal government to provide a service. The service is low-income housing, but it's not low-income when we're dealing with this, particularly this developer. If I'm paying 80% or 73% and she's paying 80% of her income towards rent and we're in low-income, how is that reasonable? And they're still getting money from the federal government. Yeah.
Senator Draham.
Thank you. I think that's more of a federal issue than a state issue. So I've tried and I've been told that it was unconstitutional for me to draft bills that affect the federal government. So unfortunately, we can't address that part of it. But I just think it would be helpful for members to understand that piece of the equation, because I think it's very complicated. And I don't know if we could freeze rents because it is a federal program. So I think that would maybe be challenged. But I'm glad we're talking about senior housing. And I think this is a real problem. And I get it. I am going to push back just a little bit on the lumping of all for-profit companies as bad. I had a bill up this last week on nonprofit executive pay. And some of those nonprofit executives get paid millions of dollars a year. And so I think there's good and bad in both for-profit and nonprofit. So I try not to lump them both or either one into the same basket. So I hope our committee doesn't do that. I have an eightplex that we bought a couple years ago with some friends, and I swore I would get back into the housing provider role ever again. But I'm a silent partner, and it's been interesting watching what they're doing with this little eightplex. And just for reference, we charge from $775 to $1,195 a unit. And we've invested quite a bit to clean it up, make it nice, like if our kids were living in the units. So there's that capital investment to fix it up. But there's also safety concerns that we address without really looking at the financial implication. If it needs to be done, you have to do it. But what I want to touch on is, in the last couple of years, what's happened to the expenses. And, you know, we've had double-digit increase in utilities. We've had double-digit increase in taxes and insurance. Our insurance has doubled for that building. And, you know, if you just average all the units, eight units, by what it costs, it's $6,250 a month increase per unit. Of course, we would prorate that based on bedrooms, et cetera, and probably base it off of bedrooms rather than just units. But if you just took the simple math, so that's $6,250 per unit a month, every month. And that's a lot of money for people on fixed income. I understand that. But as an owner, you don't have a choice. You have to pay the insurance. You have to pay the taxes. So it does work both ways that, you know, when they're increasing expenses, we have to pass it on. You know, the tax credit, that's a federal issue and not a state issue. So I don't think we can, unless Mr. Kitzberger knows different, I don't think we have any control over tax credits for that part of existing buildings. So with that, I'm glad we're talking about senior housing. I'm glad Senator Abler brought his solution to us. I just don't think it's a workable solution. So thank you.
Mr. Kitzberger, you look like you wanted to say something at one point. Did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, members, at the risk of giving the frequently bureaucratic answer, I guess, is it depends a part about, you know, there is a part of our statute that does guide the work of low-income housing tax credits along with our qualified allocation plan. And I should also mention our compliance manual that's updated on an annual basis. So depending upon what it is around LIHTC, the state does have some purview.
Members, other questions or comments? All right, seeing none, I'll just say thank you, and I'll give you the last word, Senator Abler. Thank you for bringing this bill. I, too, appreciate this conversation. This is one we should be having. I want to say again thank you to the testifiers for coming again, sharing your stories again. I agree with the comments around supply. We absolutely do need more supply, and this committee has and is doing work around that. I think of the previous investments we have made and the bipartisan work that is happening this session around zoning and land use. All of those things are going to increase supply, and that takes time. That you know, it has taken time for us to get this behind. It will take time for us to make those up and to have enough supply, and we are actively taking steps to do that. And in the meantime, there are folks who need our help. And so, you know, as we look at you know, I think there's other work that should be done especially at the federal level, to further strengthen our social safety nets. And I'm very worried about the current conversations about doing, in fact, the very opposite around Social Security. You know, I think taking steps to protect the most vulnerable, as they are telling us they need help and paying 73% and 80% of their income on housing, is outrageous and unsustainable. And taking steps
to help you all isn't, in my mind, lip service. It is the role of this body. It is the role, it is our work and our responsibility. And so I appreciate you bringing this bill. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll turn it over, this whole conversation made me think of a quote that is from Hubert Humphrey, who said, it was once said that the moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. I think that is a relevant quote for several of our bills today. And so with that, Senator Abler, last words on your bill.
Well, thank you, and I do appreciate the discussion, and some other residents are here as well today. So, and I appreciate the eloquence of my neighbors. And I hope you get a sense of my frustration. I appreciate the comments by the members who spoke. And I think if there's a single sentence from Ms. Braggelman I'll talk about, we're talking about 73% in a subsidized facility. This isn't like a market rate place that just went out of control and then they could move to somewhere else, and they could move to somewhere else. But this is a system that we set up, and it's everywhere. And I actually like my solution because it actually would address the needs of the people, but it's impractical, and politically it's not going to happen. I'm amazed at the pressure I've gotten outside of this room on this bill, and I take pride in standing up for my people. The people that are charged with, and many of the people in this room, I didn't try to get a whole list of co-authors. I've got a couple. I didn't bring 16 notes from people to talk about. I just brought this forward with some amazing seniors from Coon Rapids who are just living in the product of what between the feds and us have set up. This compliance manual we set up, and the feds set up this thing. But Madam Chair, where does conscience come into this? Senator Draham talked about rent prices that seem pretty normal to me, you know? And I think that if he were running this place, I wish he would. Because he would show some humility, like, wow, we're gonna find a way to streamline some costs. We're not gonna charge $300 for droppings. We're not going to charge $87 late fees. We're not gonna find ways to maximize revenue in every possible way. And I appreciate Mr. Smith coming, and I appreciate the answer he gave as a personal human being, which is an honorable answer that I appreciated, that at least that he hears. And I admire him in the little time I've gotten to know him. He has a job to do. He represents a group. I'm disappointed that the lobbyists for the group that we're talking about didn't bother to show up and testify why they think this is reasonable. And they hide behind a nice man like Mr. Smith. And I think if there's lip service, it's not Mr. Smith. He did his job. He did eloquent language. He went through the bill, identified the concerns. I could have written the same letter. The carpenters have the same concerns. I get it. The two good senators here who commented on the bill have the same concerns, and probably everybody else who's, mm-hmm. I mean, rent control, if this is what that is, I guess it is, only happens when the world is ending. And St. Paul tried it as a thoughtful idea, and it just fell on its face because it was too broad. I don't know that rent control is the answer here, but conscience control is, Madam Chair, and ethic is. And there was a time when people would go out of their way to make sure that their neighbors were cared for to the extent they could do it. We've moved into a time when how much can we extract? We moved into a time when people are buying up mobile home parks and raising rents on $900 on a trailer that's worth probably $3,000. And they have nowhere to go. It's the only asset they have. And we have people that testify, oh, you can't do that because you're gonna, like, where is the conscience, Madam Chair? And I'll stop pretty soon, but you go to the meetings of these seniors, there's 100 individuals like this as they're sitting there and they're hopeless, and I grieve. But I'm glad they got to tell their story today. I don't think this topic is done. The bill is not the final answer. It's a provocateur to create a dialogue. And I beg the members here, I beg the people listening, I beg the people on the board of this particular place that they would look at their conscience and go, like, seriously? I think we have enough. I think we have enough. We're good. And I think we're going to turn some of those excesses back to our people. Maybe we should give a rebate to these folks of a couple hundred dollars a month and lower their rent, because I think we have enough. Is there any place for that kind of behavior? A law is not going to do it. I've met the feds, and they're not getting along that well out there anyway. So, Madam Chair, you've been gracious with the time. Members, you've been very gracious with your attention. To be continued, but I want to commend my amazing constituents and all the other players today. So thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I'd like to ask you to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Senator Abler. And my apologies. This is my error. I normally would give you the last word. I didn't see Chair Port's hand up on Zoom, so I am going to call on her to speak as well. So Chair Port.
Thank you, Chair Bolden. Thank you, Senator Abler, for bringing this bill. It is absolutely a worthy discussion. And you have my commitment that we will continue talking about this and figuring out what the options that we can do and can pass to help this community and also others like it across the state. I'm sorry that I couldn't be with you all there today. I'm having some health challenges, but I want to just tell your constituents, the testifiers today, I've been listening carefully, and what is happening to you is unconscionable. It is absolutely not the vision that we have when we think of putting state investments into places for low-income housing that is affordable for seniors to live their lives. It's absolutely inhumane. And we can do better. I think there are ways that we can look at what sort of restrictions we can place on LIHTC properties, certainly worth a conversation. But I think it's also a broader conversation about where our priorities are, what we're willing to invest in our communities to ensure that people have safe, stable places to call home, that they have the health care that they need, that they have the education that they need. Over the last several decades, we've seen, and particularly the last 5-10 years, we've seen a massive shift in wealth in this country away from working people and the middle class to an elite 1% uber wealthy class. And that has made situations like this harder. It has made our state budget harder. And when I think about what the seniors in this community are facing, I think about what will happen if also Medicare and Medicaid are cut at the federal level. That will only exacerbate this problem in another gigantic way. We can do things about it. I'm sitting here, as you all were talking, looking through the book of tax expenditures that we have, and there are dozens of loopholes that we have built into our tax code through deals that have been made through the history of the legislature that allow large corporations or very wealthy people to not have to pay taxes on things like skyboxes at a football game. We can close some of those loopholes, raise some revenue in a way that is fair to the people of Minnesota, and invest more money in places like this. I am astounded by this. I know, Senator Abler, you've brought this to my attention. We tried to get it in last year, and we were shut down, but I think this is a discussion that we absolutely need to continue having. We need to find a way, because this is absolutely not the values of Minnesota. And it is not a good steward use of Minnesota taxpayer money that is going to places like this with the intention of being an affordable place for seniors to live, and instead is a place for corporate profits. Thank you to the committee for hearing this today. Thank you, Senator Abler. And mostly, thank you to your testifiers and their entire community that have brought their stories forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Portz. Thank you, Senator Abler. And with that, Senate File 1652 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And seeing no further business before us, this committee is adjourned.